We'll talk to electeds and candidates, experts and advocates, and then open up the phone lines to hear from you. That's Max and Murphy, Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m., right here on WBAI 99.5 FM.
There was a political agenda that the council set, and anything that didn't go along with that agenda just was put by the wayside.
One of the largest counties is Oakland County, 80,000 votes. If we can flip that, we're doing a hell of a job.
That's Max and Murphy on New York City and New York State politics, debuting Wednesday, July 18th. On WBAI New York.
And this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. It's 8 o'clock on a Wednesday night. That means it's time for Off the Hook. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Rob P. Firefly.
Good evening.
Alex.
Good evening.
Voltaire.
Hey.
And Kyle.
Hi.
Wow. Okay, well, you know what? This is the week before Hope, the week where we basically make all our final arrangements and pray for the best. Probably next week, I don't think Kyle and I are going to be here. We're probably going to be driving trucks and loading things and all kinds of other unpredictable adventures. But it's fun. It's part of the whole preparation for the conference, Hackers on Planet Earth, the Circle of Hope, our 12th conference, taking place July 20th through 22nd at the Hotel Pennsylvania. Ticket sales have stopped, online ticket sales, that is. I believe we will have some tickets available at the door. Keep checking hope.net for details on that. We're still working out the logistics. But, boy, what a lineup. What an incredible lineup. What an incredible cast of people that have been involved in planning this thing for months and months. And it's just such history. It's such an amazing confluence of people and thought and ideas and skills. It blows me away every single time. So I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be hell. We're not going to get any sleep. But it's going to be fun maybe a week or two after that when we start recovering.
I mean, is it really that much work?
It is, yes.
Yeah, I know.
You've seen me.
Yeah.
You know what it's like.
Yes, exactly. But it is, and I think the lineup is going to be pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I know I still have to do a tremendous amount of work on my talk.
Yeah.
That's right. Yep, so I'll be there. On a couple of different things, I think I'll be speaking as well. So,
well, tell us about your talk.
Okay. Without going too far into it.
No, because otherwise the authorities will try to stop you.
That's right. The authorities downstairs.
We're not kidding.
That we saw.
Yeah, we saw somebody downstairs that looked like an authority.
That's true. Yeah. They're easy to recognize around here.
They are.
They stick out like a sore thumb. So my talk, a little bit about it. One of the things that we've been doing for the last year or so is tracking Donald Trump's domains and all domain registration related to Donald Trump through the entire DNS.
How much is he paying you to do that?
Well, we do it as a pro bono service for the emperor himself.
Wow, because he needs people to keep track of every little detail.
Yeah, well, this is the interesting thing about it, actually, is that obviously we're not doing this for him, but there are a little over 61,000 domains that contain the string T-R-U-M-P in them, and we monitor the new ones every day. Just this week, there are actually quite a few about Trump baby balloons. because of this baby balloon issue in London.
And which I don't understand why we don't have that here all the time.
I totally agree.
Yeah,
it just
seems like the kind of thing that would make us all feel better.
Yep. So we identified an interesting pattern of domain registrations that were then transferred over to the Trump organization during the summer of 2016. And when we looked into this, we sort of unraveled a very interesting and strange story that involves the person who registered these domains, his intentions behind them, his background, and the fact that the Trump organization was able to identify these domains and essentially neutralize the threat. Really says a lot about their ability.
Whoa. What do you mean neutralize the threat?
Well, we're going to let out in the talk what was about to happen. To the our hypothesis, our very reasonable hypothesis about what was about to happen to the Trump campaign, and they stopped it. So what this indicates to me is that they may be really incompetent at a lot of things, but they actually are pretty competent when it comes to the control of information and monitoring information and the flow of it. And so it's going to be a really interesting story. The cast of characters is really quite colorful here. And I think that's about all I'll say until I actually get onto the stage.
Okay, and I think your talk is on Saturday.
I think I'm right in between Chelsea Manning and Steve Rombaum.
Well, that's a good place to be.
Yes. Yeah.
No, wow, okay. Yeah. Interesting, very interesting. We're going to also, by the way, have a special guest on in just a couple of minutes. Barrett Brown will be joining us from Texas. You've probably heard of him as somebody who has been... targeted by law enforcement over the years and has made quite a name for himself as a writer and activist and just an overall interesting person. He's going to be at the conference as well. He'll also be speaking, I believe, on Saturday, being interviewed, actually, by journalist Spencer Ackerman. And I think that comes before Chelsea. So, we have nonstop activity.
Saturday's going to be fun.
Yeah, well, Friday's going to be fun, too.
You think so?
Yeah, and so will Sunday, every single day. It's just... too much good stuff. That's the number one complaint we usually get is there's too much good stuff. But, here's some good news for those of you who can't make it. We are streaming the whole thing. Keep checking hope.net. We will have URLs for all of the rooms so that you can watch in full HD over the Internet and feel like you're there and see more than we'll probably see when we are there.
And this is basically a function of the Internet Society.
It is.
New York
Our
chapter.
Friends at ISOC, Internet Society, are doing an amazing job. And putting this all together.
Of which I'm on the board for the New York chapter.
Wow, okay.
So, yeah.
Well, that's a coincidence.
Yeah, it is. It happens to be a coincidence. That's right.
Very cool. Rob, any thoughts on the conference?
I'm just really looking forward to the thing getting started. So we can, I think at that point, when the conference starts, we can officially stop all the planning work because it will have been planned and it will be underway. But on top of that, I mean, so many great talks lined up, so many great workshops lined up, which is something that we don't, I think, speak about a lot on the air. But, there are full hands-on workshops with things like Arduinos and lockpicking. And we're having our amateur radio licensing tests like we regularly do. And just all kinds of...
And an amateur radio station that talks to the rest of the world. And
absolutely.
All sorts
We've
of other
got
things.
Radio Statler going.
Mitch Altman will be teaching people how to solder.
Mm-hmm. There's one on making a hologram. I'm looking at the list now. It's all on hope.net.
And lockpicking village?
Yeah, lockpicking
village. We don't have enough time. We don't have enough time to talk about all the things that will be in the workshops.
Absolutely
and throughout
not.
The whole area.
Don't forget Segways.
Oh, my God. Did we forget Segways? No, we did not forget Segways. Segways are coming. Yes, we will have Segways. I don't just mean clever musical interludes. I mean actual segues you can ride.
And to go back to the lockpicking village, I realized last time my son at the last Hope, I guess it was about 3, was just totally fascinated by the lockpicking village. I mean, we spent about an hour and a half with him playing with these locks, and it just, if you have kids and you're bringing them to Hope, the lockpicking village is a wonderful place to just kind of sit down, relax, put your feet up, give your kids a lock-picking set, and just kind of let them get off to the races. It really is very interesting to watch them try to understand how the locks work, especially when you sit at a table and they have the translucent locks that show you how the pins go up and down. Seeing their eyes light up as they figure out this is what happens when you put a key into a door and turn it is really something fascinating. I think it's a great kind of kids area, even though it's populated by a bunch of lockpickers.
That's true. And you might think it's strange for kids to be picking locks, but
no.
That is a part of the hacker community. In fact, our friends at Maker Faire get that as well. And if you go to one of their events, you'll see crowds of kids figuring out locks and opening them. And it really is educational and a valuable skill to have.
Yeah, my own lock-picking skills, I generally practice the most every 2 years at Hope, but I every time I go, there are, like, young kids on either side of me totally blowing me out of the water in terms of their skills and just how good they've gotten at it. And there's so much going on. There's great stuff to educate you and interest you and spark your interest in directions you wouldn't have realized before you got there.
Another interesting activity that's related for people that may not be able to be a part of the actual event or just want to come during the day one time is our concerts. And, in fact, I believe those are going to be downstairs in a new part of the facility. Late night, I believe Saturday is the concert, or Friday.
Friday is
look out for
Friday.
Updates. But we don't often get a chance. We're so busy with all the other stuff to advertise or promote. So I just want to remember to say something today that if you just want to come for a day, be a part of the fun, hear some good chip tunes and electronic music, you could just come to Hope and participate in that particular event, the concert. And it is incredibly entertaining, and you'll see bits and pieces of all the activity there. And it's a good way to participate if you can't get into the actual show.
Also, talking of performance, Hackers Got Talent will be happening again.
That's right.
I'm excited about.
Jason Scott will be on hand to usher in all these talented people with different kinds of talents that you might not know hackers have. And I think that's taking place Saturday late night, so check the schedule. There are so many things. We might not know off the top of our heads when they are. But if you go to Hope.net and look at the schedule, you'll see all of them there. Barrett Brown is joining us right now. Barrett, are you there?
Absolutely.
Welcome. And let me just start off by saying thank you for all you have done, for the courage you have shown, for the battles you have fought. I know it must not have been easy.
It was easier than it looks.
Uh-huh.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, let's learn something about your history. And I know that many of us have heard the story about how you were sentenced to 63 months in federal prison. But I want to go a little bit before that, because I understand that when you were a kid, you were creating your own newspapers on your family's computer, and I kind of like to learn something about that as well. Like, what kinds of projects were you involved in that inspired you to move on to other things?
Well, I was fascinated by the prospect of being able to reach, hypothetically, everyone in the world, and that was a possibility that was just sort of coming into our imagination when I was a child, and when my mom dated briefly, had a Bloomberg terminal back before the internet was something you could find in someone's home.
Wow.
But he did, and that I saw that one day, I think when I was 7 or 8, and just it occurred to me this was a thing of immense power.
That's amazing. That is something.
That's a proprietary financial operating system and tracking package by Bloomberg, right? It's their custom platform.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, this was the thing you would see in offices back in the 80s.
For, like, traders.
Very much one of the first. Sorry?
For, like, traders. Go ahead.
Yes. It was a, and what struck me was that the person who owned this happened to be very, very wealthy. And I had this vague idea that this was the source of his power and wealth, this green glowing terminal up on his level of his mansion.
So what kinds of things would you create with it?
I never actually used that. We did have a Macintosh that I grew up with and learned to read from. I think I was 3 when they got it, or 2.
Uh-huh.
So it was obviously an influential part of my makeup. And I've used it for a number of things, making choose your own adventures, using folders and documents, whereby you would open the folder and there would be 2 more folders.
Right.
It was 6 or 7, making newspapers, making satirical newspapers, starting when I was about 10 or 11, and getting a little bit better, over time. Reading about the internet, in that first Time magazine that came out, the cover reading the strange new world of the internet, and the whole magazine filled with these features on various things like BBC boards, things that I hadn't seen yet,
uh-huh.
But which I knew was going to be something that I wanted to use someday.
Wow. And, you certainly have. You certainly have pursued that and done all kinds of interesting things.
You know, I wanted to ask you, Barrett, about these sort of old newspapers and things that you made, sort of bouncing off a interview we did a couple of weeks ago with Jason Scott, who runs TextFiles.com. You know, do you happen to still have any of these old newspapers that you created when you were a kid?
Yeah, I believe my mom has several of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. You should, you know, definitely hold on to these things, archive them. You know, this is a little piece of history here, the sort of the germ from which all this grew.
Potentially. We'll see how much, we'll see how successful I am in the big things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, so let's fast forward a little bit to a few years ago, the issues with the Stratfor email leak and all that. You got in trouble for publicizing a link, I believe, to where these emails could be found. Is that correct?
That's what I was ultimately charged with that Stratfor incident, which the FBI had, it turned out, had known about. There was an intrusion into Stratfor server. Stratfor is a intelligence contracting firm out of Austin. It's been around for quite a while and does a couple different things. Some of the stuff that it does behind closed doors was revealed by this hack, which I had known about before it happened, and was involved in efforts to try to redact information out of that, which is what they ultimately got me on. They said it was a they charged me with accessory after the fact eventually for having called the company and said, look, these hackers, they have not yet decided what to do with these. They may be dumping them online, in which case I want to make sure there's nothing in here that could get someone hurt if you have an informant under a foreign dictatorship or something, so let me know. That's ultimately the conduct that I actually had to plead to. Now, originally, before that, I was facing about 105 years total worth of charges, many of which from having copied this link that the hacker had posted to Stratfor documents in an anonymous chat room. I took that link, pasted it into my Project PM chat room, which was for our crowdsourced investigation into these companies in general, which we've been doing for about 9 months by that point. That particular file ended up having credit card numbers, and they knew that I'd never opened the file. The forensics showed that. They could see from the chat, which they had the entirety of, that I didn't know what was in them at the time that I copied and pasted the link, and that no one in my group was interested in credit card fraud. This is a group of journalists and researchers. Nonetheless, they ultimately were able to use that as part of relevant conduct. So even though I never got convicted for that, they added it to my sentencing, essentially, which is one of several unfortunate aspects of the criminal justice system that kind of got publicized in the course of my case. Now, before we go on, I should note that Stratfor was not really what this was about. It was what they ended up considering to be the most viable thing to charge me with. The investigation into me had begun via secret search warrants that were sealed until the time of my sentencing, which had begun about a few weeks after my role in exposing the Team Themis scandal, which involved Palantir, HB Gary, a few other firms, in-game systems, some of which were later investigated further, some of which weren't. This Team Themis thing that was sort of a DOJ-led operation to go after activists and to go after groups like WikiLeaks, to go after their financial contributors as well, and using techniques like DDoS attacks in some cases that were, of course, if you and I did them, we would be charged for it. So that was the real thing this was about. I had done a pretty good job after the initial hack of making sure the press got this story, understood this story, and later on with a number of other people, oversaw a pretty successful investigation into these companies, into these emails, after the press had kind of gone in separate way. And that was really, that's shown by my search warrant, which was executed 4 months after Stratfor, and didn't mention Stratfor at all. I mentioned HB Gary, in-game systems, my group Project PM, and the website on which we compiled our information about all this, echelon2.org.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. You mentioned that you were trying to get this information out to the press, making sure that the public was aware of what was going on. But it's my understanding as well that you were also at least initially subject to a gag order that prevented you from disclosing a lot of information to the press or even having your attorneys talk to the press about this. I mean, how did that affect you initially?
Yeah, that was later on when I was already imprisoned on these charges that were still. But that came about. I continued to write from prison for outlets like The Guardian that I've been writing for a while about these same issues. I wrote a piece right after Snowden came forward, basically, I told you so piece, referring back to some of the other similar programs and companies as the ones, mentioned in the NSA files. In the course of the article, I did not refer to my case at all, but the prosecutor claimed in open court that, quote, or that I have been, quote, critical of the government, unquote, and that I should thus be slapped with a gag order, and the judge ultimately agreed. And so I was not able to talk about my case, which, of course, hinged very clearly on all those issues.
That was a reasoning they used because you were critical of the government?
That's a direct quote. It was reported at the time, and that's not even the craziest thing they did in the course of the charges.
You want to tell us a crazier thing?
Yeah. There was one book that was seized and listed on a list of evidence from my home during either of the raids. There was two raids, one initially when I wasn't arrested, and then one 6 months later when the SWAT team came and got me. The book that they took as evidence of a crime was the Declaration of Independence. And I made sure to bring attention to that at my sentencing when I asked the judge if I could get that book back, if he could look in to see whether or not it was used to commit a crime, and if not, to return it to my lawyers. So there's an order from the judge that was also commented upon in some of the coverage back then, in which he does have them return my Declaration of Independence. So yeah, there was a lot here that's on an individual basis was a bad sign, but it kind of showed something was wrong to the extent that the press, even the less attentive press, understood from very early on this retaliation. And that's just one of several just on its own kind of bizarre things that happened in this, and that kind of, you know, make it easier to show what this actually was, what this prosecution was.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Declaration of Independence was used to commit a crime, but it was 200-some-odd years ago, and it was under British law. So the statute of limitations has been
gone.
They're still steamed about that, so.
Another question here as well. To go back to the Stratfor leaks here, you know, when you were coming across this and when you were looking at them, I mean, did you have any idea, that there was going to be so much information there, so much about, you know, private intelligence collection? And I ask this because I feel like the relevance of the Stratfor breach is, you know, still prominent today. I mean, people still use that breach to do open source intelligence research and analysis, to do link analysis, to see what people are up to several years back. You know, it was a real treasure trove of data there. You know, what was the feeling when you were just first exploring this?
Well, contrary to a lot of the press accounts, I was never one of the ones really going to the Stratfor emails. Those went straight to WikiLeaks after we convinced the hackers involved that was the best move in that case, and they made them available gradually by a searchable form. And I was there was a few things that came out of those hacks that I commented upon widely, including Trapwire, which was a facial recognition system that on itself wasn't something I was really terribly interested in. But what did interest me was the failure of press coverage after that, when they couldn't, the press, in the course of talking about it, seemed not to understand what company it was that was actually making it, what company those were attached to, et cetera. My main thing that we did with Project PM in terms of our crowdsource researching was those 70,000 HP Gary emails that we had gotten 8 months prior, in which never systematically, were subject to a real intense search. And so we did that over time and came out with things like Romas Coin, which was a very vast apparatus involving surveillance and propaganda by an unknown U.S. Agency that a number of these companies were working on a recompete for. They were trying to get the contract from Northrop Grumman, which had held it previously. Aaron Barr, the disgraced CEO of HP Gary Federal, who had resigned after we unveiled the Team Themis conspiracy, he had actually been heavily involved in that program originally and was also a big part of this recompete with other firms. In fact, Apple and Google met with them. We know from some of those emails and some of the actual sort of Google meeting documents about working with TASC, I believe it was, Archimedes Global and HP Gary on this project. So, as you can tell, there's a lot of backstory here.
Well, it's amazing.
Your question.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, you know, just in general, yes. I mean, it's something where it very early on became obvious these were important. One of the first things that was found was this massive Team Themis scandal, which was enough to get the attention of the press for quite a while, actually. The problem is they just didn't pursue it to where they needed to. But it became clear that, look, this was a window, an unprecedented window, into this very fundamentally important sector that is very much tied up in information technology and information in general, and which operates using methodologies that a lot of people didn't expect existed, and which, you know, even now, with so much of this documented, not just by us, but by, you know, pretty mainstream outlets here and there, It's not something that's in the consciousness of the average reporter, even the average tech reporter. You'll see profiles on Palantir and Peter Thiel that don't even mention this. There was one in The Intercept, and then Glenn, The Intercept was co-founded by Glenn Greenwald, who was the guy named as a target of that Team Famous scandal that the DOJ allowed to go forward. I mean, so there's a lot here in terms of how the press works, how it doesn't, you know, what the failures are, and what we ultimately have to do to make sure that these things don't just get exposed.
Well, I'm seeing a lot of indication of how the press doesn't work. It seems like you had to hold their hand to get them to actually see the story.
Absolutely. That was a large part of what I did back then. I wrote about some of this stuff myself, uh-huh. Including the Roma Scoring thing and some aspects of persona management, which was another very, very far-reaching, very telling methodology whereby CENTCOM, using the contractor Intrepid, which is a subsidiary of Cubic, we're asking for and now have these programs whereby a single person can control some large number of very realistic fake online personas using software-assisted apparatus to help them maintain conversations with different people over time without getting mixed up, blah, blah. You know, we have some patents from that technology and things like that put forward. So there was a lot here that each on its own, I think, would have merited more long-term attention from the press altogether. If you look at it and look at what's been acknowledged about what's in these emails, it's a horrible crime in terms of our press history that this has not been really brought into the public conversation.
Well, you're right. That is the horrible crime, and whereas the way it's been portrayed, the horrible crime was people daring to see these emails in the first place.
Right.
But when you look through what has been revealed, it's simply staggering, the amount of corruption and collusion of all sorts, and it's what the role of the press is to reveal this kind of thing. Do you think your efforts have paid off? Are there more reporters out there now, after talking to you, after being guided in this way, that are more alert, especially in these times where we really need a press to be able to investigate and see what's actually out there? Are more journalists getting it now, in your opinion?
Well, yes, simply because, you know, we've had a number of opportunities to make sure this thing is revisited. My entire criminal case was one great big opportunity to have articles in The Nation and Who, What, Why and New York Times come out. Describing my case and mentioning these issues. I mean, those companies are just inextricably wound up in my prosecution. So to the extent there were documentaries about this, you know, dozens and dozens of articles, newspaper pieces, it was something that got brought up over and over again. Now, hopefully, very few of these articles really went into the comprehensive overview of what it was that we discovered, what this was really all about. But some of them did a very good job of that. And, of course, the information is always out there for anyone who really cares enough about it. That's where we get to the problem, is the caring. But it's something that I'll have more and more chances to try again, you know, to get people interested in this. I got a book coming out early next year. It'll be a pretty major release from Farrar, Straus, and Garreau. So, you know, to the extent that I get more credible, to the extent that I win national magazines awards and stuff, my argument hasn't changed. The facts haven't changed, but it does make it easier to appeal to editors and producers. But this is real, and it's been written about by their respected colleagues and all that. It's just something that they have difficulty, producers and editors in particular, even ones with very relatively good outlets, really have a difficulty believing that something big and fundamental could have been missed by their peers. And that's something that those of us who have been covered by the press have less trouble believing.
You know, we're talking about this issue of, you know, understanding and reporting, and to go back to what happened here with respect to H.B. Gary, with respect to Stratfor, and Aaron Burr, and this, you know, really seemed to have, you know, affected H.B. Gary and Aaron Burr, you know, considerably in the aftermath of this. But it seems to me like there might be an interesting parallel here, because on the one hand, we have, you know, the hackers, the hacker community, people who are peeling back the layers of this industry of private intelligence collection and the military-industrial complex and collusion and lack of media attention and all this. And the Stratfor breach was really a first look at all of this happening. And it gave us a glimpse into a world that nobody had really seen before, that nobody had really understood before, and for a lot of people it was extraordinarily scary. Yet, on the other hand, if you think about this from the government's perspective, they also had the same sort of situation, where when this happened, they then were confronted with these amorphous, decentralized hacking groups, Anonymous, LulzSec, all these sort of decentralized international groups comprised of characters that existed entirely online that they didn't necessarily understand either. And it seems to me like there might be a parallel here in terms of what they did to you. And I'm specifically talking about, Barrett, what they did with respect to your legal defense fund. When they subpoenaed the records from, I think it was WePay, is that correct?
Yes, WePay.
WePay, when they subpoenaed those records, it sounds to me like there might be an interesting parallel here in terms of what was done to companies like H.P. Gary and then what was done to you and your supporters, because they, by subpoenaing those records and getting the identities of the people and the networks of individuals that were supporting you, then began to peel back the onion layers of what was happening on the Internet that they just did not understand. I mean, have you ever thought about that parallel?
Yeah, a large part of this conflict is basically what you just described. It's one side trying to find the kinks in the other side's armor, and the other side doing the same thing. And a lot of that involves investigation, acquiring information. That's kind of a it's definitely a matter of, as a matter of extent. It's something that is very much more in play than it was previously. When, of course, you always had the FBI wants to find out what the mob's doing. The mob wants to have insiders, you know, with the typesetter and the and the local beat police spy on them. It's an old cat and mouse game that exists every time a revolutionary group or a criminal organization or anything that the government finds itself opposing, going back to the anti-war movements and civil rights movements, which were, of course, very thoroughly infiltrated, and going back to the Bolsheviks, who had a Duma member who turned out to be a Russian secret policeman. The Russians were very good at this. They pioneered a lot of the what we call human intelligence capabilities 130 years ago. This is something what you said is accurate. And it's definitely a big part of this. That's the struggle we're going to see proceed over the next few decades in different forms. It'll sort of ebb and flow like it has recently. I mean, remember 2011, the period between 2010 and 2013 when Snowden came forward, that was the big era of enforced transparency right there. In 2009 and 2013, starting with Bradley Manning. So they react. They look at their options. They look at what the threat is. They try to extrapolate and see where this is going. We do the same thing. And so they have an array of responses that sort of apply to all situations and may or may not be good, may or may not successfully adapt to us. Just as we may or may not successfully adapt to them and get to the point where we're really on their level, where we're capable of confronting them on even terms.
I think you raised a very important point, though, and people might not realize that what we're talking about here predates the Snowden revelations, predates the Manning revelations. The fact that that happened afterwards, did that change the atmosphere at all for people realizing what was going on?
Certainly, it obviously cost a lot of reporters who were covering my case to bring. That was something that was brought up. It was something that obviously made us look more prescient. Back in 2011, 2012, when we were actually doing these things, I did get a fair deal of positive coverage from journalists who understood the importance of these revelations, and that's why you'll find them referred to here and there back then in Bloomberg Business Week and Atlantic and all that. But on the whole, I think those other revelations, aside from help make it easier for me to make my case as time goes on, also made it easier for the public to understand that there's something wrong here that needs to be that the press really had a good chance, back in 2011 to fully explore and did not take that chance. But with these revelations and also with the various facets of this U.S.-Russia conflict, bringing things like persona management and bots and propaganda apparatus into the public conversation, yeah, certainly. It makes it easier for me to explain what persona management is, and it makes it easier for me to make the case that this is something that you mainstream, political party chair need to know about. And had you known about it a few years ago, things could have worked out differently.
Most definitely. Do you find that most average people get what you're saying or are receptive to it?
Certainly. I mean, these are things that are talked about in documentaries. There's two on Netflix alone about what we did with Anonymous, the Tunisian Revolution, and these investigations into the intelligence contracting world. It's something that is kind of made for popular consumption. It has something to draw them in. It has the hacking element, which people, at least back then, found very interesting. I think maybe it's dwindling. It's something that the press, the average editor, the average journalist says, oh, look, there's a hacking thing. People like that. And that was our great advantage back then because, it's very difficult to really get people to pay attention to these important things. But obviously when there's some sugarcoating around a bit that interests people, that takes the burden off us to say, hey, you know, look at this. They're already looking. The question is, can we get them to understand what they're looking at?
I want to shift gears here a little bit and talk about what you're involved in now, your latest project called the Pursuance Project. It's described as such. Pursuance is open source software that provides a better way to organize online. It provides an integrated suite of digital tools all designed to allow activists, researchers, journalists, artists, coders, anyone with talent and a little time to collaborate on projects large and small, working within customized, evolvable entities called Pursuances. Think of a Pursuance as a mission-oriented project / organization / group that people on the platform can join and contribute to. The website is pursuanceproject.org. I know you're in the middle of a Kickstarter. Tell us what's unique about this particular project and what it is that should appeal to people here.
There's two major problems we set out to solve with this. This process really began about 10 years ago when I first created something called Project PM that later on became the crowdsourced investigation into intelligence contracting. But before I got involved with Anonymous, was actually a means of building a very primitive version of this same apparatus. What this is, if you think of a ocean with a bunch of living organizational charts swimming around like jellyfish and evolving and kind of changing form over time, building connections to one another, and all those jellyfish are composed of individuals and organizations that, came into the system, got involved with another person or persons and built from there. That's kind of what this is. It's like scaffolding around a state. It is a mass collaboration environment in which, it's first of all not content neutral like Facebook, for instance, or Twitter, that you have to at least give lip service to a few tenets that we have, that you oppose the surveillance state, however you understand that term, that you oppose the police state, however you define that, et cetera. And it's populated first by us, picking about 1,900 people have signed up thus far, 1,900 people and organizations. We sort of hand-populate that system. All of them can bring on others over time. So it expands very rapidly without facing the same degree of overburdening with people who may not be proper users. It's a means of solving the problem, which I think is a big problem in the 21st century, which is how do you get large numbers of people with no prior relationships into a space where they can organize and build something out of it? And that's a problem that we kind of face, organizing online groups and movements, whether they be formal or informal, or amorphous like Anonymous. That's the key problem. And obviously we now, 10 years later, have a great deal more. We know a lot more about that. We know more about the broad implications of it. We know a lot of the little sort of mundane things that come up in that process. And so we've brought all of those things to bear on the designing of this system.
Yeah, that sounds like one of the most important features because when you do have something running on a platform like the internet, you tend to have like a rush of interest when you publicize and less sort of control as that interest peaks and then falls off. You're left with a whole lot of people that are there for what reasons it may be difficult to sort out, but that's fascinating.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly the problem. And you face those different aspects of that problem in different situations, whether it be an actual institution with a building or something like Occupy Wall Street or something like Anonymous or something like these sort of online hashtag-based movements that, do a great job of expanding very quickly and can maybe focus people's attention to go to a series of protests, as it did recently with this ICE situation. but which tend not to be able to sustain themselves. So if you think of something like Anonymous or Occupy Wall Street as a jellyfish, or some kind of, you know, globulous organism without a skeleton, imagine Pursuance as an exoskeleton that grows along with it, giving it structure that's agreed upon, you know, by the people involved, but also allows that jellyfish to keep involving, you know, unlike an institution.
This actually has a lot of parallels to, like, the interagency emergency management systems that the Forest Service employs and other crisis management structures, but in this case, specifically for the surveillance state.
I'd like to know, how do you vet people? How do you know that the people are saying they get it when they really do? How do you know they're not infiltrators of one sort or another?
We don't. That's one of a couple of problems, including, you know, the risk of security intrusion by you know, competent actors that we cannot solve to anyone's satisfaction. What we do instead, just as we have in encryption and allow people to access using, you know, whatever tools that they, you know, use in an educated way, knowing its limitations. The other end of that, the populating end, our philosophy is that if we take some steps that sort of automatically help to ensure that this population of users that we're trying to empower are largely composed of the people we think they are, and that those people are open society advocates of different kinds who may have different political backgrounds but agree on some of these core principles of open society. If we do that, we will have accomplished something. Now, beyond that, the way we discourage and de-enable infiltrators or just people who don't belong there, people who are, you know, who can always bring chaos to a project without being a cop. People, you know, people who are just should not be there, disruptive.
Oh, we know them well, yes.
Yeah, right. There's a number of structures in place here that sort of in general sort of tend to prevent them from arriving in large numbers, and then secondarily allow the individual participants who are building these pursuances, these organizational charts, expanding them, to ensure that to the extent those people get in, their ability to harm things is minimized, whereby they can still be put to work on things, you know, on minor things that, you know, are not hugely important, and get a chance to contribute. So there's a number of ways that Pursuance can be set up such that new users have no real access to the information that an adversary might want, while still, you know, kind of allowing them to contribute in ways that do prevent a barrier of entry for an intelligence contractor, the national sort of cybersecurity forces of a dictatorship abroad, or anything else. And there's more to this than that, but those are the broad, that's our sort of broad philosophy, our approach here, is to tell people, look, we have no, without taking on like very authoritarian powers over exactly who gets in, and subjecting people to scrutiny and, you know, all that, we can never guarantee that everyone in here will be on the up and up. What we can do is discourage them, make it harder for them to do damage, and give you the tools that you can use to decide for yourself exactly what level of sort of personnel security that is appropriate for your group.
Right. They can slowly establish merit through these tasks and work their way on this this project or pursuit.
You know, and
exactly.
And on the other hand, I wanted to bring up sort of the flip side of this. If we're creating a pursuance to serve a certain population of users that want to be engaged one way or the other on the Internet and work in some kind of collaboration because they're activists, they're working on a certain cause, you must have given certain thought to the fact that if this is some sort of centralized place where people can collaborate, you may in fact be doing a disservice to these users that you're trying to serve if, let's say, you're served with a subpoena. You must have given some thought to the fact that, you know, legal process will inevitably be served upon you, and you have to make a decision about what you're going to do with certain user data or even certain metadata. And how do you prevent, or how have you sort of designed around that obvious threat?
Right. Of course, given that I spent 4 years in prison, it would be kind of surprising if I hadn't thought quite a bit about those issues. It would also be surprising if we hadn't been asked those things very early on, rightfully so. And so we have a number of ways we have gone in which to make that very difficult and very unlikely. One of those is working closely with Drizzy Jomsdottir, the Icelandic member of parliament, head of the
friend of the show.
Oh, Birgitta, yes, we know her well.
Yes, yes, yes. She's a board member on Pursuance and now sort of our global ambassador.
Wow.
Working with other state and private entities. So we have, we will not be having servers anywhere that the U.S. can get them, for one thing. For another thing, I don't want to go into the exact terminology, so I don't want to get it wrong, but Steve Phillips, our lead developer, who comes out of the crypto community and sort of hyperspace community in San Francisco, works at a Noise Bridge quite a bit. He and other people who have contributed either input or actual coding have approached this in a way. It's some decentralized method. You know, you have to remember, I have no computer background. When I saw that Bloomberg terminal, you know, again, I was very interested in being able to organize people, but I don't really care what's going on inside. So, but we do have people who've written explanations of that. You find in part on our Kickstarter page, as well as in the talks we've given at Aaron Schwartz Day, a few other things, radio programs here and there. But we do have all the information sort of collated there on the exact specifications of how this network is distributed so as to avoid that very complication.
Right. So there's a mechanism. There's a mechanism for double blind identity and so on.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's there's several others aside from that. Steve Phillips, our lead developer, also creates something called LeapChat, which is a zero knowledge communication platform that's integrated into this. We have input, you know, from former NSA people like Thomas Drake, you know, of course, who he's not on our board, but he came and spoke at our panel we organized for RightsCon recently and has been involved kind of just helping us out. We also have John Kiriakou on our board, former CIA torture whistleblower. So we have a number of people who, to the extent that there's something we forgot, we'll have no problem telling us. So, but again, anyone who wants to see those specifics should go to the Kickstarter page and look at the links there. There is a great deal of solid information about that I'm just not qualified to convey on a hacking radio show.
We're speaking with Barrett Brown, a journalist, essayist, activist, somebody who can motivate, I think, a lot of people to actually get involved. And one thing you said that really struck a chord with me seeing the power of the technology without having to dive in and understand every little bit of it, because I think so often we tend to get mired down in that, where if you use the wrong terminology, all of a sudden everything you say is invalid. I think that by focusing on what the power of the actual tool can be, you leapfrog over so many stumbling blocks that normally would get in your way.
Absolutely, that's especially true because Twitter has many, many critics of both useful and
yes.
otherwise that will come and explain these things to you at great length. Happens a day.
They're in real life too, but all over the place.
I imagine.
But Barrett, I want to give you the opportunity give out the info so people can get involved in the Kickstarter, get involved in the project, whatever you want people to know about.
Yeah, absolutely. So pursuanceproject.org is our main website. There's a link to the Kickstarter at the very top of that. That's the easiest to remember. There is a Kickstarter link, of course, but I wouldn't know how to go about saying it in a meaningful way. so just go to pursuanceproject.org, and you'll see the link to the Kickstarter there.
That's right.
Your website itself has plenty of information and links to articles that have appeared in the New York Observer, Wired, Vice, about this project and kind of what it does from their standpoint. Obviously, it's useful for crowdsource research, bringing activist groups into emergence, taking NGOs, nonprofits, letting them better mobilize and effectively and really viably use large numbers of supporters, all of that thing, and helps them to figure out how they want to work together and makes it easier to do that. So we have a number of constituencies, and we have a number of other groups, organizations that have kind of given us a nod because of that. So all of that can be seen at the website.
So I may not mention the topic of, like, not prioritize, like not getting fixated on technical specifics and making stuff more usable, making it so that it's more available to more people. Can you talk more about like your choice to use according to the FAQ, using front end clients like mobile and web? It's going to be JavaScript based like React Native and Electron, and those have been criticized by the cryptography community for being very vulnerable to lots of attacks. So But on the other hand, they also make it easier to port apps to multiple platforms to get into the hands of more people. Can you talk about, like, how you come to that decision and how to choose what rather to prioritize security or availability?
Well, the actual nuances of the security it's not a decision I would ever make because I'm not competent to make that decision. Instead, that all of the specifics and sort of the grand the larger picture was all sort of thought out by our technical people, of course. And they've explained a lot of the specific reasoning on that. Steve Phillips is on Twitter under at Alima Steve, ELIMISTEV, and he's engaged with a lot of our critics, including one today, about things like Tor and why, you know, despite these reservations that, you know, even Tor has, you know, that no one really denies who's educated on the issue, those are things we certainly facilitate. Beyond that, so I couldn't speak to, for instance, JavaScript. I have no idea what's different from JavaScript than any other coding language. I know nothing about it. What I can tell you is that our larger security philosophy here, both in the technical sphere, is based on the proposition that we're up against very, very competent adversaries who have historically and just in recent history been shown to be able to infiltrate any number of things that were not widely viewed maybe viewed by specialists, but not widely viewed as vulnerable, and that they're going to surprise the specialists every now and again, and they have. And so we tell people that, well, first of all, most people using the Pursuant system are just doing more mundane kind of things than the kind of thing that we have to worry about, that we have to worry about security for, and that no one should come on to here or use any system, up to and including having a personal conversation 2 feet away, without knowing the specifics of what's vulnerable and what's not. Parabolic microphones have been around for quite a while, so have police informants. So I make certain to always point out that this is not 100% secure, and nothing is. And that's something that everyone should keep in mind no matter what they're doing and no matter under what medium they're doing it.
Yeah, I think that's a good and very realistic attitude when involved in this sort of thing. And I also think, maybe this is a bit unusual, that you actually learn something when there are infiltrators. You learn their techniques as well, assuming that you find them, and you usually do. You learn about your vulnerabilities, but you also learn about their tactics. And I'm not saying people should seek out infiltrators, but I think what Barrett is saying is that to some degree you can expect it no matter what sort of system you're using. Certainly the attempts, whether or not they're successful, that desire is always there.
Certainly. I mean, we had a day after Aaron Barr was in the Financial Times and said he'd infiltrated the anonymous server and identified all of our, you know, quote-unquote leaders. You know, we had all of his notes, and so did the press.
Wow.
So we learned a lot from those notes and some of the, there was stuff in me about them, which I confronted him on the phone about, put up on a recording. And there's other measures that, you know, as someone who's not an intelligence specialist, I can assure you, and it really doesn't even like the subject. You know, I'm a you know, historian by temperament, a classicist by temperament, not a modernist. I can tell you that it's not hard to think up ways in which to squeeze more juice out of that lemon. Calls to former employees, you know, thinking out a phone call and questions you might call and ask the Vice President Booz Allen Hamilton at 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning, as I did once and listed in my indictment, as I believe.
Wow.
there's all number of, you know, that was one of my favorite things to do is call them early on, just like a Gestapo, ask them questions, record it. And very often, if you think it through beforehand, you can ask questions that are going to yield accidental answers that, you know.
This is why you're dangerous. This is why the authorities are so scared of you, because you do things like that and you think these things through.
Certainly. That's nice for me. It's very complimentary that they do feel that way from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think obviously that's an endorsement right there. I mean, basically this is the DOJ has been interfering with this project in particular by having cut off my income until from about a year ago up until literally today when my publishers was now allowed to pay me.
Really? Wow.
You know, well, they sent subpoenas. There's articles about this as well. They sent subpoenas to The Intercept, to Macmillan Publishers.
I heard about that.
And then after that, they ordered my publisher not to pay me any money until further notice while they work out the garnishment. I do owe $800,000 to Stratfor because of that hack at the FBI. as shown in other court documents.
And this is something that's very standard when people are prosecuted, that they try and cripple them however they can. But if you're ingenious, you always find a way. Voltaire, you have one more question?
Yeah, and it's understandable at this phase of the project, but there hasn't been a security audit yet. And would you consider adding for a stretch goal on your project a security audit?
The security audit is definitely one of the basic things that we're acquiring money for to begin with. In addition to that major security audit, we're also going to be asking certain other semi-public figures on a pro bono basis to also have a crack at it, you know, to some extent.
That's great. And the source code is available. It's under the Affero GPL, so anybody can use it. It also requires that when it's out in the wild, it's going to require that all the end users get their modified source code, which I highly commend you on.
Now, Barrett, we're running out of time here, but I just wanted to ask you quickly, how do you find that you mesh with the hacker community? Has this community been supportive of your ideals? Is this a positive environment?
Well, back at Anonymous, it was very mixed. Obviously, there was a lot of people that did respect what I did, that knew exactly what I had been working on. But there was others who got a lot of their information the same place Soccer Moms did, from Time Magazine and NBC. And
right.
So sort of took some of those things literally and thought I was going around calling myself the official spokesperson or whatever. But since then, I mean, a lot of the people that were my opponents back then are now, you know, have changed their minds. We get a lot of help from people, the Aaron Schwartz people around him, for instance. We get a lot of help from a lot of people who have a background in activism, whether or not they understood what I was doing back then. Generally, you know, the DOJ going after me like that was very helpful in a number of ways, and one of which was giving people a chance to see in writing in a courtroom setting, you know, what it was that I was actually doing, as opposed to some of the things they might have believed I was from press coverage and whatnot. I don't work with a whole lot of hackers directly myself right now, but there's a number attached to this project who are, you know, looking forward to using it to help develop tools and whatever. I've never really, you know, I've never hung out with hackers if I can help it.
Well, you're coming to Hope, so you're going to meet a whole lot of them. And
I've been there before. I've read it myself.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, we're looking forward to having you over there. One final question, though. A lot of our listeners, not a lot, but a fair number of listeners, find themselves incarcerated one way or another. And I just think your words could be very inspirational to somebody who finds themselves being prosecuted, being muzzled in one way or another. Is there anything you can tell people that might have them looking forward to something that they can accomplish as far as revealing the truth or just simply getting past these hurdles?
Yes, actually. There's something very specific I can tell them, which is that one of the first pursuances that will be created when the pursuance system starts will be run by us and will be dedicated to prison reform. It will make use of contributions from current inmates. We'll potentially be working with some of the groups that I don't want to name yet, but you will have heard of them if you're into prison reform. And we're going to be ensuring that these administrative remedy forms that you are filling out, trying to get a court to allow you to challenge the due process violations to which you are subject, we're going to ensure that those start working differently, that we've got a very long-term plan that's going to start soon to get that done.
That's great. Barrett Brown, one more time, give out the information for the Pursuance Project, how people can donate and help make it a reality.
If you go to pursuanceproject.org, there's a link to our Kickstarter at the top of the page. We also accept Bitcoin donations, and there's information for that on the donations page on pursuanceproject.org. There's just Google Pursuance Project. You'll find a number of articles, by Wired and The Observer, you know, talking about the potential uses of it for journalists or for researchers, that sort of thing. You'll find other articles about how NGOs can use it, how individuals can use it, and what it might accomplish in the long term.
Great. Well, Barrett, thanks so much for talking to us over this last hour, and we really look forward to seeing you at Hope.
Thank you very much. I look forward to it as well.
All right. Have a good night.
Adios.
And that was Barrett Brown speaking to us. And again, he will be at the Hope Conference. Details on who else will be at the Hope Conference at hope.net. You can write to us, oth@2600.com. We'll be back again next week with a pre-Hope show. I'm sure we'll be all going crazy at that time. Until then, have a good night. Stay tuned for the Personal Computer Show. We'll be right back.
And this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.